Greece's debt problems aren't all that's plaguing the European economy. Spain and Portugal have also seen downgrades in their credit ratings. And the response by the European Union to that crisis is being watched around the world. We're joined now by Jerzy Buzek, the president of the European Parliament. He's at the European Union's delegation to the United Nations office in New York. President Buzek, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for the invitation for this interview.
You're going to bail out Greece?
Yes, it will be a response as usual in the European Union. Solidarity is our main slogan in the European Union for the last 60 years. And I'm confident that decision will be taken during the next days.
I've read some opinion this week that suggests this was exactly what some people worried about with the euro, that there'd be economic problems in one, two, or three countries, and you couldn't contain them because, of course, you had a common currency. And now you have Greece's problems dragging in the rest of the eurozone. How do you address that concern?
First of all, we must say that we are at the beginning of the process of organizing our eurozone. It's less than 10 years yet, so it's not so easy. On the other hand, we have very deep crises all over the world. So it's nothing unusual that also some countries from the eurozone are affected by the crisis. And I'm quite sure we can manage.
Mm-hmm. But do you also, for example, in this case, have countries with very different approaches to debt and spending, say, between Greece and Germany?
Yeah, it's also obvious because we are saying in the European Union that we, of course, base our community on solidarity, but responsibility every separate member state is also very important.
May I ask, Mr. President, did the member states of the eurozone do a good enough job in checking out the Greek economy before they joined in 2002?
It must be checked, maybe once again, by the European Commission. I wouldn't like to say anything about that being a representative of the European Parliament, because it was not our responsibility, it will be not our responsibility in the future as well. But of course, as members of the European Parliament, we are very, very interested in everything what is connected with the recovery from crisis, exit programs, and also about the Greek crisis.
Hmm. So assuming a bailout for Greece, you think that that will have the effect of improving other particularly plagued economies in, let's say, Spain, Portugal, and Ireland, and that means they would be less likely to have to ever request a bailout?
I'm optimistic because if we solve, and I'm sure we will solve the problem of Greece, it will be much easier in other countries. I know very well, I talked to Mr. Prime Minister Papandreou a few weeks ago, and they prepared a very tough, difficult program for Greece. It will be not easy, but if it will start working, it will be great progress in Greece's economy, and then will be no danger for the whole eurozone.
Jerzy Buzek, who's president of the European Parliament, joining us from New York. Mr. President, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
This week, Gillian Duffy of Rochdale, England, popped out of her apartment to buy a loaf of bread and walked into the news. Mrs. Duffy is 65 years old, a widow, a pensioner who worked with handicapped children, a grandmother, and a lifelong Labour Party voter. But when she was ushered over to shake hands with Prime Minister Gordon Brown, who was on her street to be televised meeting people, Mrs. Duffy told him she was absolutely ashamed of saying I'm Labour. She complained about high taxes and all these Eastern Europeans immigrating to Britain. The Prime Minister genially told her she should be getting many good government benefits from paying her taxes. But a moment later, after sliding into the privacy, or so he thought, of his car, Mr. Brown called the encounter a disaster and referred to Gillian Duffy as a bigoted woman. The Prime Minister still had a microphone on his lapel. It was on. When he went to a radio studio a few moments later, he heard his own words played back to him and put his head in his hands. A camera was still on him, too. The picture of Mr. Brown holding his head in his hands has become an instant icon of despair, like a man who can't bear to watch his house burn. Mr. Brown rushed back to apologize to Gillian Duffy. Aides attested that he was mortified, more personally than politically, to have insulted a Labour-voting grandmother. What a horrible, mean-spirited thing to do, rasped the Daily Star. The Express newspaper thundered that Gordon Brown has been unmasked as a hypocrite who praises people to their faces and then insults them behind their backs. But from this distance, I thought Mr. Brown didn't look mean so much as exhausted, a man in a pressure cooker who vented a little steam in what he thought was a private moment. Was he two-faced? I suppose. But so's anyone who tells someone that he looks fit, then mutters to a friend, "What's happened to him?" or laughs too loudly at a boss's obnoxious joke, or tells his mother-in-law, "I love this mincemeat pie," then murmurs to his spouse between burps in the middle of the night, "Is she trying to kill me?" For that matter, I've known many reporters who flatter politicians to their faces, but talk waspishly about them behind their backs when they're safely having drinks with other reporters. Multiple personalities may not be healthy, but a couple of faces can just help you get through the day. I doubt that Gillian Duffy deserved to be called a bigot, even privately, but I feel some sympathy for any politician who, toward the end of a toilsome campaign, snaps back a bit at the public he thinks is about to bite him at the ballot box. Hey, this mic isn't still on, is it?
Hello, testing one. Are we on?
Hello, testing.
1, 2.
Testing.
1, 2.
How do you do? Testing.
1, 2.
It's
one. Eric Idle, Neil Innes, you're listening to NPR News. We're joined now in the studio by Mark Udoff, who's president of the University of California. President Udoff oversees 10 campuses around the state and a budget of more than $20 billion. Mr. President, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you for inviting me.
The University of California system has raised, they don't say tuition, fees by 32%.
Yes, sir.
Reduced employee salaries, curtailed freshman enrollment. That invites the question, how does that square with the mission of a public university?
Well, let me start by saying this is a fabulous university, and my mission is to preserve and protect and to defend the University of California. That's what I do every morning. And in May of last year, my budget was cut 20%, the core budget, which was around $3 billion. So we had to do some things which I genuinely hated to do, which are genuinely unpopular, mm-hmm. which have caused suffering among our students and our faculty. So I would say it's not consistent with our mission. It's not what I want to do. It's not what the faculty wants. But it's necessary to preserve the place. So we had a progressive furlough program. Lower-salaried people had a 4% reduction in salary. People like me had a 10%. We raised tuition 30% plus to a little over $10,000. It's still a fabulous buy. With the California grants and the Pell grants from the federal government and the Obama tax credits, for 2009-10, three-quarters of all families below $180,000 in family income did not pay any of the fee increase. So it's not a trajectory we can stay on forever. Mm-hmm. And I think ultimately it may hurt the middle class more than the low-income students. There's more financial aid available to them.
For low-income students, yeah.
But it's really the best we can do under very difficult circumstances.
You enjoyed such a distinguished background at University of Texas, University of Minnesota before that. Would you have taken the California job if you'd known this was ahead?
You know, I've thought about that a lot, and I think I would. I mean, people write to me from other universities and say, "Mark, you have to succeed." And they don't mean me personally. What they mean is if the University of California is in danger, the whole system of public higher education in America is at risk. UC Berkeley has more academy members than the whole state of Texas. Last time around, the Nobel Prizes in economics and medicine were University of California people. This is a magnificent institution with a magnificent faculty. And I think that's worth doing. I mean, it gives me a purpose in life. I really wish we had surplus money and I were worried about different initiatives. I would certainly like to expand our enrollment rather than contracting it. Mm-hmm. I think that's partly closing down an opportunity faculty. But I think I would have taken the job. And you get to hang out with really great people. We have great students. Now, it has its trying moments, sometimes with a demonstration here or there, but it's a fabulous job, and I'm really glad to be there.
What's your vision for the University of California system 5 years from now?
Well, my vision is that we will stabilize our finances, we will retain our faculty, we will renew faculty hiring. I guess I'd say we're on the right trajectory in the sense of a 100-year trajectory, not the last 2 years. I don't know what the future holds in terms of the financial model. It's broke. We get more expensive over time. That's been the history of the last 10 years. They wake up in Sacramento and say that, you need prisons and you need to take care of your prison population. We need public safety. But that's not going to make us competitive around the world for having the best prison system. We need to cultivate the idea that
to finish your sentence, the implication being that University of California education system will make it competitive.
Will make a competitive difference because it's like your seed corn is what I was going to say. You need the human infrastructure. California and in general this nation will never be the low-cost employer. It will never be a deregulated economy. We care about lots of things. I mean, who wants to cut out dental care for low-income people? That's a horrible result. But in the end, you have to grow the economy, and it seems to me education is the smart bet to do that.
Mark Udoff, President of the University of California, thanks so much.
Thank you, sir.
President Obama took a 2-day swing through the rural Midwest this week. In many ways, it was a typical domestic trip. But for NPR's Ari Shapiro, everything was new. He's just joined NPR's White House team. He sent us this reporter's notebook about his first trip with the president.
A cardinal sin of journalism is what's known as burying the lead, putting the biggest news late in the story. So let me begin with the end of the trip. Flying home to Washington, President Obama walked to the back of Air Force One and took reporters' questions. He has not done that in months. And just when it looked like he was done...
Okay. Thank you, guys. I'll give him the last question since this is his first ride on the plane.
Senator Leahy. I asked about the Supreme Court and conservative judicial activism. My first question to the president capped a trip full of firsts. The journey felt like a campaign swing. President Obama toured a factory, kissed babies, rallied crowds, and visited a family restaurant in Mount Pleasant, Iowa, for a slice of rhubarb pie. When the white-haired waitress offered to brew him a fresh pot of coffee, the president declined.
Oh, no, you can give me the old.
Traveling with the president is known as being in the bubble, but to me it felt more like dominoes. People spend weeks meticulously placing each domino in the right spot. And once the first domino falls, the president, his staff, and the media zoom from the airplane to the helicopters to the motorcade to the rally to the town hall meeting. In Quincy, Illinois, we ran into a hall where a few thousand people were waiting. We plugged in our laptops, and the event began.
Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States.
We didn't see the line of people who had waited days earlier to get tickets, or the hours of security screening the audience went through once they arrived at the hall. And once the speech was over, we were gone. Sometimes plans change at the last minute. Wednesday morning, the President decided to hit the gym in Des Moines. Reporters waited next door at a coffee and comic book shop. That's where we spotted a comic book called Barack the Barbarian. The cover showed a shirtless Barack, abs rippling, holding a battle axe in one hand and an elephant tusk in the other. Sitting on top of the elephant was his nemesis, Red Sarah, laughing maniacally. I bought the comic, and some of the White House staff asked to see it. So back on Air Force One, when we were done with the serious questions, I decided to ask spokesman Bill Burton.
Barack the Barbarian?
I have seen that comic book. I liked it because it had few words and lots of pictures. It made it easy to understand.
He added, when you come to Iowa, you see all sorts of fun things. I know exactly how he feels.
NPR's Ari Shapiro. This is NPR News. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. I'll bet every Chicagoan has a story like this. You're somewhere in the world and someone asks you where you're from. When you say Chicago, instead of saying President Obama, Oprah, or Michael Jordan, they train their fingers like a Tommy gun and say, Chicago! Al Capone! More than 60 years after his squalid and glorious death, this powerfully built man with two long scars in his left cheek is still perhaps the most famous criminal who ever lived. Jonathan Eig, a former writer for the Wall Street Journal and author of best-selling books on Lou Gehrig and Jackie Robinson, has written a book about Al Capone's life and crimes and the federal effort that brought him down. Get Capone, the secret plot that captured America's most wanted gangster. Jonathan Eich joins us from our studios in Chicago. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Help us understand how big Al Capone was in the world.
He was huge. He was on a level with Babe Ruth, Charles Lindbergh, and it was because he came along in the 20s when celebrities were just in love with the spotlight. And Capone was the first and really the only criminal who decided that he wanted to be famous too, and he embraced celebrity.
He called his criminal enterprise the Outfit. How did it operate? How did it make money?
It was very loosely organized. We have this image now of him as this overlord who was in control of every bar, every casino, every speakeasy and brothel in Chicago. But in fact, it was a very loosely organized operation, and that was in many ways the key to his success. He didn't try to micromanage. He let the bar owners, he let the gambling house operators do their thing and collected his portion. And his big job was to make sure everybody stayed happy, so paying off the cops, paying off the courts, making sure that his guys didn't go to jail. He was very good at that.
How smart was Al Capone?
His IQ was 95. He was of average intelligence, at least on that metric. But I think he had a real gift for organization, and I think he was a terrific people person, very gregarious, very well-liked. This is not the popular image we have of him, but in fact, he was a lot of fun to be around. I think that was really more the key to his success than his intellect.
Well, but when you say he was a people person, I mean, he killed people, too.
Yeah, he killed people, too. That's part of being a people person. It's just the dark side of it. He really went to great lengths to engage people and to build a fraternity around him. That's how he survived in this business. And he really did try to keep the rival gangsters at peace. And when he couldn't, then he took care of business. And that's part of being a good businessman, too, when you're in Capone's racket.
St. Valentine's Day Massacre, 1929. There were 7 people slaughtered in a Northside garage. It was thought to be Capone's strike against the Bugs Moran gang, and it's often credited as being the event that the outrage was so great it drove the federal prosecution effort to finally put him behind bars. You have some new information in this book.
That's right. I've always been suspicious. It doesn't make sense for Capone to have done this. In fact, the feds were already breathing down his neck. It also doesn't make sense that he would have gone after Moran in such a dramatic way and missed Moran. Moran was not killed. So I came across a letter in the FBI archives that offers just a completely new theory. This letter suggested that one gangster got knocked off, his cousin came after the guys who did it, and in his rage, he killed everybody on the scene. I think everything about it that I was able to check out was supported by the facts.
Mm-hmm. Now, I believe, wasn't it Bugs Moran that said, only Capone kills like that?
Yeah.
He would have wanted the federal strike force to go after Capone for that.
That's right. What better way to take out Capone than let the feds do it? You know, Moran would have been able to expand his turf dramatically. But even the cops and even the feds knew that Capone didn't do it. And a part of the problem was that there was a lot of suspicion that the cops may have been in on this hit. And that's why the investigation never went anywhere. And that's why eventually we just came to blame Capone just by force of his sheer reputation.
You say that Elliot Ness and the Untouchables should have been called the Inactives.
Yeah. Ness was really more of a nuisance to Capone than a serious threat. The real guy in charge of the investigation was George E.Q. Johnson. He was the prosecutor, the U.S. attorney for Chicago, and he was getting orders from the president, Herbert Hoover, that he wanted Capone in jail, whatever it took. Ness never came up with any evidence that was useful in prosecuting Capone. All he did was really break up a few stills and raid a few brothels, but really never made an impact.
And who developed, which I think is an idea that's hallowed even to this day, emulated even to this day, the idea that instead of trying to get Al Capone on the most flagrant, dramatic crimes, like murder and for that matter bootlegging, just get him on taxes?
Yeah, the credit for that goes to George Johnson. He tried it out on some of the other gangsters in Chicago. He tried it out on Capone's brother, Ralph, and put him away at Leavenworth for 3 years. And it was really the only chance they had against Capone. And they had real mixed feelings about it. They were worried that they'd be laughed at, that the government would be mocked for taking down this notorious criminal, this obvious killer, and getting him on nothing more than a tax charge. So it was a very interesting decision, very important decision to go after him. And the Justice Department today still refers to it as the Capone method.
You make the case in here that Al Capone, who could have afforded the best legal counsel in the world, might have been misserved by his attorneys. They might have been suckered by the government.
I think they were suckered by the government. And I think that Capone never saw it coming. He hired the guys who he usually hired for his criminal defense work. These guys knew the courts. They knew Chicago. They knew how to play the game. They knew who to bribe and how to take care of juries. But they didn't know anything about tax law. And I think Capone did not see the severity of this tax case, and he did not imagine that he could possibly go away for so long. He ended up being sentenced for 11 years. Mm-hmm. And Capone figured, these guys will make a deal for me. That's what they're good at. And when it turned out that you couldn't deal with the government in this case, Capone was in big trouble.
He hated that nickname, Scarface.
You wouldn't like it very much either, I suspect.
Well, yes, that's true. But on the other hand, I don't have scars on my face. And wasn't he in a business where it would rather be good advertising to have scars on your face?
Yeah, but you have to understand. I mean, look at the way Capone dressed. He wanted to be seen as a businessman. And he really believed that he should be seen that way. And the scars really bugged him. He would go to newspaper editors and beg them to airbrush his photos and to at least have the photographer shoot him from the other side. And he would say, how do you think my mother feels when she sees me called Scarface in the newspapers?
Does the media bear some responsibility for Al Capone's prosperity by building him up into such a big figure?
Well, the media certainly made him famous, made him infamous. And I think the media is responsible for his legend and why it continues to intrigue us so much today. Capone courted the media. He loved these reporters. He loved giving interviews. And the reporters loved him right back. And then you've got, even in Capone's lifetime, even in the early 30s, movies made in which he's clearly the star of the show. You know, they're clearly basing these movie characters on his life. So very quickly, he could see that the public was becoming obsessed with him.
Well, what is the nuance that's been missed for decades as far as you're concerned?
I think Capone was a complex man. I think that he was a two-bit thug, really, who almost accidentally found himself in this position of power and extraordinary wealth and made the decision that he would try to do it in a business-like way and would try to go public with his activities. And that was a terrible mistake. You know, he should have, like the other two-bit thugs, he should have remained quiet about his illegal activities. But it was a human error, and he was a human being. And I think that, I've discovered a lot of new papers a lot of Capone's own letters. I talked to his family members, and I think what emerges is that he was a very complicated person, and I wanted people to understand that he was not the character that you see in the movies.
Jonathan Eig, his new book, Get Capone, The Secret Plot That Captured America's Most Wanted Gangster. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And you can read an excerpt of Jonathan Eig's new book on our website, npr.org.